the mother fasting, that the fetus actually was terminated, it was destroyed, or it resulted in the death of the fetus, then she becomes liable for the
blood money.
For the blood money. Otherwise, she will not.
Mm-hmm. And what about the other questions?
The last question was very much similar to the first question, actually.
Uh-huh. I see. Okay. Somebody asked, a lady, upon delivery, God Almighty blessed me with a son who's being breastfed. The blessed month of Ramadan is approaching, and at present, I'm capable of fasting. However, if I fast, my milk will dry up, and as I have a, weak constitution, and my baby wants milk every 10 minutes. What should I do?
Well, if there is fear, genuine fear, of harm to your baby due to a reduction caused by fasting, the reduction in the quantity of milk, of course, or maybe it might fasting might result in drying up the milk. The milk will get dried up. So in this case, of course, she has to break the fast because it's necessary for the mother to take care of not only herself but also the child.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, of course, the mother has to give 750 grams of food as fidya. Because of not fasting and because of suckling the child and breastfeeding the child, she has to give 750 grams of foodstuff to the poor Shia Muslims. And also, she must observe the qadha after the month of Ramadan.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, after the break. Stay with us.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan, ahi qulubana bil Qur'an.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad Hossein, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh, some physicians who are not truly committed to the Islamic laws or might not be aware of them, basically, forbid their patients to fast, claiming that fasting is detrimental to their health. Should their orders be acted on or what?
Well, if the physician is not trustworthy, his statements do not, in the sense that his statements do not bring any confidence to the person who refers to him, and of course, his words cannot be taken for granted. It means that whatever he says, that the patient should actually look at himself or herself to see whether he can fast or not. And she has, or maybe he has enough experience. Maybe the doctor tells him, you shouldn't fast, because many doctors in this time around actually want to suggest to their patients, to their clients, okay, don't fast because fasting is going to hurt you, it is going to harm you because you will get dehydrated and so on and so forth. Of course, if he is trustworthy, if he's sincere in his advice, then he can, and there is also a kind of fear that actually is there with the patient. He has to go ahead and break his fast. But if he is not, if he by way of experience, he understands that, okay, he can fast and fasting will not be harmful. I have seen many people who are suffering from diabetes. In the month of Ramadan, they say they are in a better condition than they used to be, because they don't eat a lot of sweets or maybe sugary things. So finally, at the end of the month, they are doing much better than they used to be, actually.
But you know that those people who are suffering from diabetics should actually hydrate themselves with a lot of water. They have to drink a lot. So if they can't drink, especially in those areas where fasting becomes too long, like the days are too long in the summer, for example. Yeah.
But in this time around, you know, there's a hadith from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family. He said, "Sumu tasihu." Okay, you should fast and you will be healthy. If we trust this saying of the Prophet, then and we observe fast, of believing course, that fasting will have its positive effect on us.
But if they are sick already, if they are ill.
Yeah, that's another thing. If your health is going to deteriorate, and get worsened, then you understand it yourself.
Exactly.
Your personal experience shows whether you're doing better or not.
Sheikh, regarding the question that I asked you,
yes,
is being committed to Islamic laws necessary for the doctor's orders and prescription to be taken seriously by the patients, like for not to fast?
It is not.
Their only medical profession is important, right?
Yeah.
So if they know something, they know what they're doing.
Yeah, that's why His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if his advice brings confidence, and it's a kind of reassuring to you, gives you enough confidence that, okay, fasting may be somehow negative, it may prove to be
harmful for the condition,
you should stop fasting.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mahajad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, somebody asked, my mother was ill for a period of almost 13 years and couldn't fast. I know for certain that what prevented her from this duty was her need to take medicine.
Yes.
Please enlighten us if it is obligatory for her to perform the qadha of these missed fasts.
Someone who is persistently and continuously sick and remains sick is not supposed to fast. And of course, fasting is harmful for such a person. And because fasting is going to endanger his or her health. Now, when it comes to this mother, as you gave the example of a woman who could not fast for 13 years, of course, if she remained ill throughout the following year, the ensuing year, the year after the month of Ramadan, until the next Ramadan, there is no...
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawbid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
You're welcome. We are still in the month of Ramadan, this blessed month of God, in which we try to, in fact, touch on some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the month of Ramadan, according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me start this episode with this question, Sheikh. A pregnant woman does not know whether fasting will harm her baby or not. Does she still have to fast?
Well, if she has reasonable grounds to fear that fasting would harm her baby, then it's not obligatory to fast. And if there's no such ground, there's no likelihood or fear that it might cause any damage to the baby or to the mother's health, which ultimately will have bearing on the child's health, then of course she must observe fast. Because I've seen many women who are very strong, very sturdy, and very healthy. Mm-hmm. Fasting does not affect their health. Right. And so they have to fast. It's not, when there's genuine fear that it might damage the mother's health and as a result the child's health, mm-hmm. of course, she does not have to fast.
I see. A pregnant woman fasted, Sheikh.
Yeah.
When she delivered, the baby was found dead. Means that there was a miscarriage.
Yes.
From the beginning, she had thought that her fasting might be harmful, but she fasted nevertheless.
Hidden Files. The scientist gave no mind to security warnings that fateful day. He had to return from his vacation to teach a class the next day and wasn't going to let anyone stand in his way. After 14 years of high security, perhaps he was just ready to face his fate. Whatever it was, he hit the road and not long afterwards, the news was blasted everywhere in the country. Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the father of Iran's nuclear science, had joined his martyred colleagues assassinated by the Israeli regime. But just who was Dr. Fakhrizadeh, and what had he done to deserve the honor of martyrdom? And why did the U.S. and Israeli regimes plan this assassination and more in hopes of dismantling Iran's nuclear program? Well, my dear colleague Mariam Azadeh is joining us with a bit of history on this topic. Mariam, please tell us more about Dr. Fakhrizadeh.
Well, thank you, Marzi, and greetings to your audience. Now, over the years, the authorities of the Islamic Republic have declared time and time again that the country's nuclear program is merely for peaceful purposes. Iran signed the Treaty of the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons in 1970, and careful investigations and reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency have shown the Islamic Republic's compliance with the treaty over the years. Even more reassuring than the treaty and the IAEA reports is the clear and strict stance of Islam that is the very foundation of the Islamic Republic. Even at the height of Saddam's invasion of Iran, when the Ba'athist regime in Iraq was bombing Iranian cities with chemical weapons, the late leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, declared that it's forbidden for the Iranian military to respond in kind. he himself prevented the production of chemical weapons on the grounds that Islam does not permit using weapons of mass destruction aimed to inflict harm on civilians. Then there's the verdict issued by the current leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khamenei, that reaffirms that the use of WMDs using chemical weapons and nuclear weapons is strictly forbidden in Islam. And yet the U.S., with well over 5,000 nuclear warheads, and the Israeli regime with some 400 nuclear warheads, have committed countless crimes to stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program. But it seems that these crimes have only made Iranians more determined in their pursuit of nuclear technology.
I'm very happy to welcome to Hidden Files two of the sons of Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. We have Dr. Mehdi Fakhrizadeh and Dr. Hamid Fakhrizadeh. Welcome to the program. I'd like to start off with, of course, a very difficult time, the day that your father was assassinated. How did you find out about it?
In the name of the compassionate and merciful God, it was around 2:20 p.m. on November 27, 2020, when my mother called me and altered a sentence that echoed in our minds for 20 years. In that phone call, she simply said to me, "Mehdi, they've shot Dad." A three-word sentence I'd been waiting to hear every day for two decades. At the time of the call, the sounds of explosions and chaos were audible because my mother was the only one with my father. When I inquired about the location of the incident, I learned that the incident had occurred in Absard County. Immediately, we coordinated with my brothers and reached the site. When they had transported my father to Absard facility for initial treatments, we arrived and later, he was airlifted to a hospital in Tehran.
It's so difficult. I can't imagine. And your brother said you were waiting for this for 20 years. What does that mean? What is that like to be waiting to see if your father is going to be killed, become a martyr or not? What does it mean?
As my brother Mehdi mentioned, particularly in the last 15 to 20 years, life had been challenging for us. Despite my father's efforts to prevent security issues and pressures from affecting the family, the created security conditions had entangled the entire family. Nevertheless, he never abandoned his efforts to achieve his goals, which were nothing but the elevation and empowerment of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the country. The first attempt on his life dates back 20 years before his martyrdom, and during these two decades, there were four unsuccessful terrorist operations against him. In a video, Olmert speaks and says, "We wanted to assassinate Fakhrizadeh."
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
And when the reporter asks how well he knows Fakhrizadeh, he replies, "I know him well enough that if I see him in a crowded street, I can easily recognize him."
Well, what about you guys? I mean, did you ever say, "Okay, it's enough. It's too much pressure"?
No, fortunately not. Anyway, a part of these tireless efforts, or as Iran's leader calls them, enduring efforts, belongs to our adolescence or a part of our childhood, which we understood to some extent. But our effort was one of our goals, and we are thankful that we were with him in understanding through mutual understanding, companionship, and solidarity.
You said pressure on you and also your children before and still.
Yes.
What kind of pressure right now? What are we talking about right now?
In two or three segments, we can define the pressure on the family. The first segment was before my father was introduced and recognized, meaning the time when he was on the hit list and attempts were made to assassinate him. Incidents had occurred, but intelligence and security services and the Zionist regime had not yet introduced him to the public. These pressures were internal and stemmed from concerns, anxieties, and potential losses. The second segment was when the intelligence services began to introduce him, meaning becoming recognized by the people. When he became known to the public, we too involuntarily became known, meaning we had to answer various questions. In many instances, we denied our relationship to inter-various fields, but in some cases, we couldn't deny it, and various kinds of damage were inflicted upon us. For example, one aspect that was not important to us but turned out to be a positive outcome was that many individuals in the business sector cut off their professional ties with us due to concerns that their business connections with us might lead to their sanctions. This was a part of the pressure at the time. After the martyrdom, some of the past pressures lingered and new pressures were added. I want to mention a small emotional aspect, the loss of a prominent figure, which apart from being a prominent figure in the world and national arena, we have significant effects. We heard that during his lifetime, he was recognized by Foreign Policy magazine as one of 500 powerful figures globally. In any case, the world recognized him as someone who had accomplished significant events. This recognition of his personality also existed within the family. Nevertheless, when this powerful pillar is removed, everyone, relative to the depth of the relationship they had with him, is affected. An example is a question my youngest child, who was only 2 years and a few months old at the time of his martyrdom, still asks me, when will we become martyrs and join Grandpa? I emphasize that the discussion is not merely about his removal or exclusion from the nuclear issue. Of course, the majority of the issue was related to nuclear matters because it was a highly sensitive and a strategic matter for Iran. For Iran's enemies, a country like Iran being equipped with nuclear knowledge independently and without the need for another country with the long-standing sanctions was an unacceptable issue that they could not tolerate.
Okay, let me leave it right there because I'm going to ask a question a little bit later about okay. that particularly. Okay. But you had mentioned about his personality. I want to talk a little bit about who he was as far as a father in the house, just his personality in general, hobbies. Tell me about your father.
It can be said that he had a multidimensional personality. When we look at the personal dimensions, we see he was a poet and a literary individual with a strong interest in literature and involvement in literary matters. In another dimension, when we look at his personality, we see that in the field of philosophy, he had his own opinions and thoughts. His entry into the realm of philosophy dates back to his 16 years of age when he became interested in philosophical subjects. Prominent philosophy professors acknowledged that when he came to the Sadr Philosophy Institute, he raised questions and had answers to those questions that did not even cross their minds. These subjects were not discussed in either the religious or university context, let alone providing answers to them. In the field of management, when you look at him, he managed a complex set of operations in 16 different areas. This involved working with hundreds of scientists and achieving results. One of his oldest colleagues and friends mentioned that Fakhrizadeh did nothing during his 30 years of service unless it was the first time in the country or the world.
What an amazing life that he had. With your father, you said that you had been waiting for that news for 20 years. What would he say to you all? Because obviously he knew that he was a target. What would he tell you about the possibility of him being martyred?
At various times, events occurred, and some of them we became aware of unintentionally, while others needed to be brought to our attention. So he did. Of the four or five instances of assassination attempts that happened to him, perhaps we became aware of one of them after his martyrdom, but we were involved in three or four of them during his lifetime. This was because we also had to be prepared for such events. Preparations had various aspects, and we had to be prepared for after his passing. Perhaps the paternal recommendations or last-minute advices are one of the interesting aspects of such events. Sometimes an individual may give advice once, but for us, within 20 years, we're always involved in these events, as if a person, if their death is destined to happen, experiences it once in a sickness or deathbed, but it was on the brink of such events every day. Therefore, for us, every day was a final day, and he had last-minute recommendations for us every day.
Amazing. Amazing. When did you find out about the type of projects that your father was involved in, or did you find out, did you know the importance of his work?
I have said this in several places. Just as much as my father was unknown to the people in work-related matters, he was also unknown to us. He was never in a situation to talk about projects or the work he was doing and achieving results at home. Even after 3 years, I still hear things about his work and projects that are new to me. Naturally, more than 90% of the activities carried out by Marty Fakhrizadeh or are currently ongoing are not open for discussion because they are confidential.
Absolutely amazing life. Let me ask you, Matthew, did you ever think maybe we shouldn't just insist on nuclear technology? For example, the Islamic Republic of Iran, of course, we know that there have been, you've mentioned, several nuclear scientists who have been martyred. We know the Islamic Republic has advanced technologies in various fields, from nano to stem cell technologies and others. What would you say, I mean, if Iran just gave up on its peaceful nuclear program, why not?
There are two discussions or two dimensions here. One is the discussion of nuclear energy, the discussion of nuclear technology and nuclear knowledge. We're not only talking about nuclear energy, we're talking about nuclear technology and knowledge. Today, everyone knows that it has various applications and is among the fundamental and foundational sciences. It has diverse applications and is strategic for the country. Therefore, the country must focus on the development of nuclear science, even though it has been repeatedly emphasized, mentioned, and even examined that Iran's nuclear program is a peaceful program. Unlike many other countries, where their primary use of nuclear technology is for military purposes and violates human rights, Iran has a peaceful program. Today, good information is provided that exploitation must take place in various fields, including agriculture. Iran, like other countries, cannot and should not be deprived of using this knowledge and technology to secure the interests of its people and the residents of its cities. The second issue here is that knowledge, especially cutting-edge technologies, is empowering. Empowerment has various aspects, with the most significant being independence for powerful countries. These countries strongly resist dependence and do not want other countries to become independent. They always prefer to be in need and are inclined to maintain dependencies, reaching out to other countries.
Right. Well, your father wasn't the first scientist, as I just said, to be assassinated. And it was by the American and Israeli, of course, regimes. And these assassinations were not only to slow down, to halt the progress of individual projects, but also to send a message to others not to go into that field, not to do that. Do you think that they have been effective in sending that message to others or not?
دقیقاً روز بعد از شهادت، یعنی شنبه صبح بود،
Perhaps it was the morning after his martyrdom, a Saturday morning, when I explicitly, in the first interview I had with some television networks, wholeheartedly stated the following sentence: an arrogant regime such as Israel should fear the martyred Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as much as it feared him alive. This is a reality, at least in the events after the martyrdom, where in fact when we complete the puzzle of the assassinations, we come to two points. Firstly, they are genuinely still afraid of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and now they fear him even more. Secondly, the very subtle message of the supreme leader regarding his actions and activities, illustrating how impactful one can be not only within the geographical boundaries of their own country, but far beyond. One could boldly say that he was not just an Iranian scientist, but one of the greatest scientists of his time in the Islamic world. This is an undeniable fact. Some of the work he did was closely tied to his personality, knowledge, and capabilities. Naturally, after his martyrdom, these tasks cannot continue, or if they do, they may continue with less power or force. In certain areas, given his high managerial abilities, his work on succession planning and establishing suitable structures or projects and other matters would not necessarily come to a complete halt with his martyrdom. We certainly hope that, following the explicit orders of the leadership, all his scientific and technical activities in all areas he was involved in will continue. I would like to mention a point related to this matter which may be relevant to your question. At the beginning of the message announced by the supreme leader the day after the martyrdom of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, he states, an outstanding and distinguished nuclear and defense scientist. But where he wanted to say, go and carry out his work, he did not say, go and carry out his nuclear work or go and carry out his defense work, because the supreme leader knew perfectly well in which areas he was capable. Where he wanted to give orders for his activities, he used the phrase go and pursue his work seriously. Let the officials follow up on all his scientific and technical work in all areas he was engaged in. We hope that following this strict order of the supreme leader, the work will proceed well. I have said this many times. Iran has shown that the youth within its borders are all capable and worthy. This soil has nurtured Soleimani. This soil has nurtured Fakhrizadeh. This soil will never be devoid of individuals like Fakhrizadeh, and God willing, the work will proceed smoothly.
Do you have any final comments? I mean, if we look at the overall situation of the Islamic Republic of Iran now and technology, are you optimistic about the future of Iran?
Exactly. In any case, over the past 40 years, we have demonstrated that we can open the greatest peaks of knowledge and technology in various fields from within ourselves and relying on our own capabilities. This includes nuclear technology, nanotechnology, stem cells, computer science, and today, in artificial intelligence and more. We have international documentation, scientific articles published by Iranian youth in emerging fields demonstrate that Iran is highly capable and performs well. We have witnessed significant growth and advancements, and we envision a bright future for our country. In the end, the point I want to make is that the assassination of Martyr Fakhrizadeh and those like them is a blow not only to Iran or the Islamic world, but to human society. We lost a scientist, and they assassinated a scientist who was engaged in fundamental and foundational activities in the field of science, contributing to the beneficial development of human society. These assassinations occur to achieve malicious goals that certain groups have, not for the sake of human society or even for a specific nation. I emphasize that these assassinations occur for the sake of goals that certain groups have. Hopefully, the global community will wake up to this awareness and we will witness the confrontation with such behaviors, the result of which is a violation of the human rights of different nations and a gross violation of human rights in general.
Yes, we hope so. Thank you both for being with me, Dr. Mehdi and Dr. Hamid Fakhrizadeh. I appreciate you being with me.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back with more of the program. And thank you, viewers, for staying with us. Don't go away. There's more to the show. Stay tuned.
Now, some may ask, with so much pressure on Iran to stop its peaceful nuclear program, with all these sanctions and the sabotage of Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iran scientists and more, why doesn't the Islamic Republic just give up on its nuclear program? So let's go over a few reasons. Now, one of the major uses of nuclear energy is in the production of electricity. France, for instance, gets 70% of its electricity from nuclear energy. Now, for Iran, a country with a dry climate, using nuclear energy instead of hydropower plants is ideal, and it's dedicated at least 5 nuclear power plants to the production of electricity. This technology has many uses in the agricultural industry, from genetic modification to pest control using sterilization to water usage control and much more. Now, these are just some of the reasons that the Islamic Republic insists on making use of nuclear technology like other countries, and it has the right to do so. But it's not really about nuclear energy. Over the years, many sanctions have been placed on various other types of technology in Iran as well. The main goal is to keep the Islamic Republic of Iran from progressing, a goal that has clearly failed.
Fakhrizadeh, the Iranian nuclear physicist, vaccine developer, university professor, and more, is no longer amongst us. Now he's reached his dreams of martyrdom while fulfilling what he deemed the holy mission of working to advance his country and serving his people, the dream of giving everything he had for the worthiest cause he knew. Now, today, the same criminal entity that took the life of Fakhrizadeh continues to commit a genocide in Palestine. The same entity that accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of reaching for nuclear bombs has dropped over 40,000 tons of explosives on the Gaza Strip alone, breaking the record of American nuclear bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in death and destruction. But just as the mass murder of Palestinians has not stopped their resistance against Israeli occupation, the assassination of Iranian scientists has only made Iranians more determined to advance their country through their peaceful nuclear program. Well, Iran has certainly lost a few heroes, but the Israeli regime has lost face to millions of people who are taking to the streets to denounce its crimes across the world. And it's just as Imam Khomeini, the late leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, had said, "Go ahead and murder us. It will only awaken the masses."
For today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The Zionist regime is intentionally starving people in the Gaza Strip, which has resulted in full-scale famine in the besieged territory. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The electronic intifada wrote, Fari for Hamad is in her 70s. Although she has witnessed a huge amount of brutality in her life, she has never experienced anything worse than the current genocide by the Zionist regime. It is the first time that she has ever suffered from extreme hunger. Tharifa stayed in Beit Hanun, northern Gaza, for a number of months after the Zionist regime declared its war during October. Yet in recent weeks, the situation became so serious there that she moved southwards. For 2 months, Tharifa had to bake bread using animal feed. She said, "We had no other choice, otherwise we would die of starvation." As they lacked fuel, Tharifa and her husband had to burn their own furniture and clothes so that they could cook a little bread. Flour and other food items have been unaffordable when they can be found in markets. A can of peas has been priced at $8 in the north of Gaza recently, whereas it would sell for only around 25 cents before the war was declared. Apart from bread made with animal seeds, Tharifa and her husband have had to eat leaves from trees and paper. For the few days before she left northern Gaza, Tharifa had nothing but salt. She said, "The salt raised my blood pressure. I began to feel dizzy and I could not see clearly." She added, "I didn't know if I should keep eating salt and die of high blood pressure as there was no medicine in the city, or should I stop eating salt and die of hunger?" Tharifa's journey to southern Gaza was arduous. As Tharifa was weak, her husband had to drag her on a wooden panel for hours on end. He had to stop and rest every so often. Tharifa fainted in the last hour of the journey. Some people came to her aid and sprayed her with water. When she regained consciousness, she drank some water and ate a few dates that people they had just made gave to her. Tharifa and her husband were given more food when they arrived at Deir al-Balah refugee camp. She said, "My tears started falling when I saw some real bread. I had nearly forgotten what it tasted like." She was able to eat sandwiches containing meat from a tin, cheese, and hummus. She said, "They tasted delicious." Khaled, Amir, and Saad are three children whose parents were killed by the Zionist regime during the current genocide. For months afterwards, they had just one meal per day. It consisted of fried potatoes, often potatoes that were rotting, or bread soaked in butter. They obtained a little flour when eight trucks managed to enter the northern part of Gaza. The flour was leaking from an eight truck. It was just enough to bake a little bread. The first fresh flour-based bread that Khaled tested in more than 2 months. Khaled took a major risk to obtain that small amount of flour. The truck from which he got the aid had been driven to Arashid Street, southwest of Gaza City, on February 29th. The Zionist regime killed at least 118 Palestinians waiting for aid on that day. For a number of days, the children had nothing to eat at all. Their weights dropped drastically. Khaled said, "I passed out from starvation." He was rescued by some neighbors who gave him sugar, some bread, and canned beef. Without anyone to provide for them, the children moved southwards. They did not know where to go, so they just followed others. Along the way, they succeeded in meeting up with an uncle. Eventually, they arrived in Deir al-Balah, they are living in a tent. Abida Abu Esma, 67, had to leave her home in Gaza City's Beish refugee camp during the current war. She was staying at a school located in Jabalia area when it was invaded by the Zionist regime troops. Her husband was taken into detention during the invasion. Abida's husband had previously been imprisoned for 7 years by the Zionist regime. Initially, she remained at the Jabalia school after the Zionist regime troops took her husband away, yet she had to leave it when food ran out completely. She fell during her journey of evacuation. A paramedic helped her, and she tried to walk again, but it was too painful. As a result, the paramedic had to carry her on his back until they reached Deir al-Balah. She is taking shelter in another school there. Books from its library are being burnt for heat and for cooking. Her husband remains in detention, and she hopes she will still be alive when he's released. She said, "At least we won't die of hunger here in the south. It would be better to be killed by bombing than by starvation."
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be your host in today's episode. And, of course, like always, we have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Muzaffar, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And as the ritual of this program goes, I would like you to introduce yourself briefly.
First of all, assalamu alaikum to you and all your dear listeners. I'm Nahid. I'm a graduate of TFO, and I've been studying and researching on Muslim issues, and especially Muslim women issues. And I'm so glad and honored to be here with you.
Yeah, so good. And you, brother?
I am Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I've been studying in the Hawza for the past 10 years in the holy city of Qom. And here I am today with you lovely people.
Thank you very much. I wish both of you luck and success. As always, we in here in Back to Reality, we come to bring up some topics and then to see what are the ideas, what are different perspectives on different topics. As for today, I am going to put it this way. Do you think happiness is the purpose of life?
Happiness is the purpose of life. Yes, it is.
Yeah, thank you. So to those who say yes and to those who say no, if happiness is not the purpose of life, then what is the purpose of life?
Exactly. That's my point. Exactly. If it's not happiness, what is it?
Yeah.
You know, what I think is that there are many perspectives on life. And when it comes to happiness, we should first define happiness. Like, happiness is one sudden feeling in us human beings that makes us so excited about achieving the goal. What I mean is that without a goal, we won't be happy. Mm-hmm. So happiness is not the process. Happiness is the destination. We work hard. We try. During this process, we not necessarily are happy. But when we achieve our goal, at that very moment we feel happy.
It's only a momentary thing, is what
yes.
you think.
Okay, and you, if happiness is the only purpose of life,
Well, the thing is, the way that Sister Nahid has defined it is a very temporary thing, and in that sense I can agree with it. That would not be the purpose of life, because it's only a short-lived thing. However, the happiness that I'm talking about is true happiness, inner peace kind of happiness, which should be one of the goals of life. And even if we do say that it's only a temporary feeling, then, you know, that catharsis should be something that we strive for.
Yeah. Okay, but... is that the satisfaction within ourselves? Like, we are satisfied with the situation that, working, that we are working for?
Yeah, yeah, because without that peace, you're not going to acquire what we would refer to as happiness, right?
Are we able to achieve that happiness?
I would argue that yes, you are. Okay, so the happiness that I'm talking about is slightly different to the way that the Western world, or perhaps even the modern world, would define it. There's a hadith of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and he says that the fruits of the intellect is a surur, this happiness. You're going to get joyful through the intellect. So there are four faculties within mysticism in Islam. You know, the whole akhlaq, the great akhlaq masters like Allama Tabatabai, Ayatollah Bahjat, Imam Khomeini, all of these greats, they always speak about four human faculties. One is the aql, the intellect, which is supposed to be the guiding kind of spiritual force within you. It's always pointing towards God. One of them is the imagination, another is anger, another is passion, desire. Now, a human being is supposed to have all of these things, right? Even passion, you might think that desire is an evil thing because it draws us towards our lower animalistic self. But without that, you're not going to enjoy your food. Can you imagine life where you're not actually enjoying eating your iftar after fasting? The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, there are two joys for a fasting person. The first is when he opens his iftar, you know, that first bite of food. And the second is when he meets his Lord. These are all about happiness, that joy of existence itself. Coming back to the four faculties, why is this significant? Because I've asked numerous people from my friends and relatives, which faculty does happiness actually belong to? And they all said the desire, the shahwa, the passion. Meaning that the Western world has pretty much defined happiness as being something that you acquire through eating, drinking, and through fulfilling the other
physical materialistic senses, right? Things.
But that is not happiness. I remember seeing a talk somewhere, and he was talking about how happiness is separate from pleasure. Pleasure is one thing.
Yeah.
Happiness is another thing.
Yeah, in that case...
But does that make sense? I mean, it's not the way that we're defining happiness.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in that case, I can just refer to that thing that I mentioned, that people are defining happiness in different ways. And unfortunately, a lot of people believe in happiness in a way that we just feel happy of achieving something or fulfilling our needs. But even going back to our own purpose in life, like even if we want to consider the other schools of life, Islam, I don't know, the other schools at the same time, in many acceptable logical schools, we are asked to work for self-improvement and self-growth. Even through achieving those goals, we need to be satisfied with ourselves. We need to be happy with the thing that we are working for. That is a kind of satisfaction within us that, yeah, it can lead to that meaning of happiness, which is sometimes the opposite side of what is shown to us, what is kind of dictated to us.
So we go for the break, and then after that we'd follow what we were talking about. Welcome back. Well, you're listening to Back to Reality. Brother Mozaffa and Sister Nahid are helping us with the topic of happiness. Okay, so far we've talked about these two very important issues, that there is a difference between pleasure and happiness. Pleasure goes for all the materialistic and physical stuff, and then happiness is something deeper. It could be equal to the peace, inner peace that you might feel, or satisfaction. And then also you mentioned the fact that the process of achieving something is going to lead to happiness.
Yeah.
Now the question is, haven't you ever been in this situation where you pursue something so passionately, so hard you try for it, but the moment you achieve it, you feel like you're not satisfied?
Yeah, for sure. In other situations, you achieve something that you just made it so big, you exaggerated it in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment you achieve it, you realize that it's not worth working that much. Yeah, we feel this. But what I am thinking of right now is connecting the things that our brother mentioned to my own belief that when we enjoy the process, when we know what we are working for, when we know what feeling we are having within ourselves, even if we achieve that goal and we don't feel that much happy, we still can be proud of ourselves for tolerating all the tough situations, all the hardships throughout our way.
Yes, you're proud of yourself, but you're not happy.
Yeah, it may happen. You're not happy with that definition that you need to be just so glad of achieving something, but you are satisfied of your process.
See, when I say happy, I exactly mean the satisfaction that you must get from whatever you have done. Like, it's not to persuade yourself that I'm happy for whatever I did. No, it must be something that comes intuitively. So naturally, I don't know if I'm making my point or not.
No, it's very interesting, sister, because different people will define happiness in different ways.
Yeah.
For you, happiness is defined as a feeling of satisfaction after a struggle.
Not necessarily a struggle.
I thought that's what you said.
Not necessarily a struggle in whatever you do.
It's an achievement. Okay, satisfaction in that achievement.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
But then you can't achieve something. The Holy Quran, you know, states, "Inna ma'al usri yusra." Surely with difficulty is ease. And part of the philosophy behind that is that if you want to achieve something, you've got to struggle before it, right?
Of course.
It's gonna, you know, if you go to the gym, you're going to work out, and then you know you get bigger or you know more fit because you've gone through the struggle. So that is something that will give happiness. There's this bodybuilder.
But then, there's also another verse that says, "Innal insana lafi khusr."
Surely human beings are in loss, completely lost.
So then I guess there is no such a thing as happiness to be the purpose of life.
It is very important. However, you know, it's not the purpose. If you're striving your entire life to acquire happiness, chances are you're not going to get it.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Maybe among the people who are listening to us, there are those who are in a younger age, and then they feel like there comes a moment in which they're going to feel this complete happiness.
Yeah.
But then this is an illusion.
You know, have you ever met somebody who's happy all the time?
They are faking that happiness.
Thank you. It's really irritating, isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
But why are you happy? It's not a happy day.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Be sad sometimes. And this is the natural balance that a lot of human beings need to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I need to learn myself. Where you need to be happy some days, you need to be sad some days. It's okay.
Yeah, that's
the Holy Quran states, وَأَنَّهُ هُوَ أَضْحَكَ وَأَبَكَ. It's He, Allah, who causes people to laugh and cry. Now, we have to recognize that this journey through life, where, you know, through which Allah is essentially creating us, is a journey of ups and downs, and we've got to learn to be satisfied mm-hmm. with those ups and downs.
Exactly. And then we have, just as we talk about happiness, since we human beings understand things based on binary oppositions, then comes the concept of difficulties. So when we're talking about happiness and the fact that happiness in the sense of the worldly, in the worldly sense, could not be achieved as in an everlasting feeling and emotion, we're not going to achieve it, of course. But then comes the concept of difficulty.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
The purpose of life is not happiness, and there are a lot of difficulties in the way. Why?
You know, again, we need to talk about our goals, our purpose. If happiness is not our purpose, mm-hmm. then we surely need to
not
have some goals.
Not that it's not our purpose, you know? It's not that consciously I want happiness and I cannot achieve it. It is not the nature of life to give you that happiness that you have in your mind.
Yeah. Life is designed for us to, in a way that we are going
it's
to face
a test.
Difficulties.
It's an ongoing test. Yes. So if for a moment you think you're happy and everything is going to last like this forever, yeah. then you're dead wrong.
You know, if you're talking about the difficulties and the hardships that we're going to face, mm-hmm. What I always think of this, how I always think of this is in a way that I try to practice with the things that I believe in, you know? Mm-hmm. For example, I'm working hard for something. I don't know, I'm studying hard for a test, and I'm having a really tough time. I'm having a lot of challenges, talking to my family,